Good afternoon. So last time we started talking about threading. We reviewed the idea of a multi-threaded process, that we have things that belong to a process, like open files and memory, and things that would belong to individual threads, like stack, registers, and also sort of the scheduler state, because we mentioned that when we were talking about what the scheduler did, it scheduled threads, it didn't schedule processes when we have multi-threaded processes. So then we looked at the POSIX interface for creating threads, which is what we're going to be dealing with in assignments. So we had pthread create was sort of the thread version of fork. So fork creates a new process, pthread create creates a new thread in the current process. Unlike fork, that thread runs a particular function, and we kind of can't make it work like fork because it needs a new stack. You know, because we share memory, that means if we have two threads running with the same memory, they need to have different stack pointers. So, you know, we can't just, you know, copy the stack pointer as is. We need to make some changes and start a different function. And we saw that we could pass an argument to the thread as a void pointer. This is just this interface used because that's how you make a generic type in C. If this were a C++ interface, it would look different, which you can see by looking at the C++ standard library threads interface, if you wanted to do that. Then we talked about pthread join, which is kind of the equivalent of wait PID. It waits for a thread to finish and retrieves the return value, which again is via a void star, which is just a generic type that represents any pointer. We saw we could pass things in there by casting them to void star and then casting them back. And we mentioned that unless the thread is detached, we need this to clean up the thread because, you know, at the least, the library that implements pthread create and pthread join is keeping around the return value of the thread. So pthread join will work. So if we don't want it to be keeping that extra stuff around, we need to tell it explicitly, hey, I never plan on joining this thread. And we saw that this detach operation could do that. Then we looked at several examples of how we can pass values to and from threads. We saw that because threads share memory, if they're in the same process, we could just use global variables, or you could have pointers to things that were local variables, and those pointers would still work in the other threads because they all share the same memory. So we could have pointers to, say, the main thread stack or to the heap. And as long as the things being pointed to were still allocated, that would all work fine. And after that, we started looking at, well, you know, we had all these ideas where we created a thread and joined it when it was done. What if we want to share data more frequently rather than, you know, having the thread do everything, wait for it to finish, and then look at what it did? What if we're sharing data and accessing it simultaneously from multiple threads? Started thinking about what should happen then and what does happen then. So before we continue that, questions about these things we covered last time. Okay, not seeing any. So let's go back to our examples from last time. So we mentioned here that, you know, it seems like for this that we'd say, okay, we have three possible values for X, which is set here, that either thread A could read Y is 0, the initial value, and get an X of 1. It could read Y is 2, the second value, and get an X of 3, or it could read Y is 4, this third value, and get an X of 5. And this depends on whether this first operation ends up running effectively in either of these three slots. And sort of the way we usually think about two threads working at the same time is that you know, conceptually, there's some order in which the operations appear to happen when they're working on the same thing. That somehow this read of Y here happens at one of these three points. There's not a notion of it happening in the middle. But, you know, that's sort of our usual assumption. But with that being an assumption, right, let's think about here. Give another 10 seconds or so. Looks like we have. Okay, so pretty much almost everyone thinks just one or two. And the reasoning behind that is, well, you know, either thread A's write happens last or thread B's write happens last. But this is making an assumption about how writing to X works, that's a reasonable assumption, but, you know, we could imagine maybe it would work differently. Let's say that the two threads needed to write bit by bit to X that, you know, was stored as an array of bits. In that case, we could end up with three. And if that happened, you know, that, I mean, it makes sense that if we write bit by bit, yeah, that it could be the case that, you know, B's write to bit 1 happens after B's write to bit 0, and A's writes happen in between, so we get that value of 3. But this doesn't sort of match our typical intuition of how writing to a variable should work. And a good question is, well, what do processors actually do? And we're going to get to that. And, you know, we're going to hope, for the sake of reasoning about code, that processors don't do something like this. And the answer is going to be, well, it's not so great. But we're going to have ways of dealing with it that are going to avoid this problem. And if we think about this type of scenario here, you know, of why isn't it three, if we have the same issues with this prior example, we could imagine, oh, if it works bit by bit, you know, we could also end up with cases where we read in between values, because if we imagine that, you know, this write to X and Y happens bit by bit. And that assumption that, you know, you're all assuming when you say, when we run these two, this code, we're either going to get one or two, is that the write is something we call atomic, that it happens all together or not at all. We should sort of, this is without being, you know, interrupted. So like you can't see the middle of the operation, that either we see X has the value before being set to 1 or X has 1. We don't see anything in between, and the same with 2. And you know, it makes sense that you think loading and storing values in a variable is atomic, and probably the biggest reason why you might think that from what you've learned before in prior courses is that if you think of the assembly, well, in assembly, this is like move 1 into X. You know, that's one instruction. We can't divide, that's not divided up into pieces in the code I expect my compiler to generate. And on most machines, happily enough, loading and storing what I call words, so this is sort of natural sized values, where the natural size is typically the size of a register, is atomic, that it happens all at once, it runs to completion, you can't see the middle of the operation, or it doesn't happen. You're not going to have a value half stored or half loaded and have something else happen in the middle of that store or load as far as the effects of the load or store. You're going to get the whole thing or, you know, or nothing. You're not going to get half of the value in some way. And so that prohibits that three answer, if this is true. And you might say, okay, you told me loading and storing is atomic. Don't you just mean instructions are atomic? That if I have an instruction, you know, it either happens or it doesn't. That I don't get these in-between answers. And on a single core, that's exactly what we'd expect. That I, if I have an instruction and I'm doing context switches, I can't context switch in the middle of an instruction because we have to, you know, go back to the program, and we can't go back in the middle of an instruction. But when we're dealing with multiple cores, we can see that some instructions that you might assume were atomic aren't. And I'll give an example of that in a second. So the question is, if the load and stores are atomic, can we still have the answer be one or two? Yes. So here, if loading, writing to X is atomic, well, that means that, you know, the write of one and the write of two are both going to happen all together without being interrupted by each other. But we still don't know what order they happen in. So atomic tells you that the whole thing happens without being interrupted, but it doesn't tell you that, you know, it happens before or after anything else. You need some other restrictions to make that be certain. So questions about this idea of atomic operations. Okay. So, as I said, you might assume, based on your sort of intuition about how, you know, assembly works and therefore how machines work, that instructions would be atomic. But this is not always true. And a good example of this on x86 is that x86 add instruction. So x86, you can add, say, one to a memory location. If you're used to Intel syntax, this would look like add to memory at RAX one. So this is one instruction on x86, and you might say, okay, well, that just, the addition happens all together, right? Because it's one instruction, and that's not how the CPU implements it. And this means that some things you might imagine would always work won't. And we'll give an example in a second. So another thing that's not atomic is that loading and storing values that cross cache blocks is often not atomic. So I have this little parenthetical remark here, aligned, which means that if it's a multiple of the size, it's usually atomic. But if it crosses cache blocks, it's usually not. And in both of these cases, what you can think of as happening is that even though it might be one instruction in assembly, the processor might implement it by doing multiple separate operations. And that means the overall instruction isn't atomic, because we can see some but not all of the operations that make up the overall instruction happening. So as an example, I mentioned add on x86 isn't atomic. So here's that add instruction. And basically what I'm doing here is I have a global variable. I increment it in a loop that runs a number of times specified by my argument. And I run this function in two separate threads. So this is update loop here, running in two separate threads with an argument of a million. So I run that, I wait for the threads to complete, and I expect the value of the global variable to be 2 million, because I've incremented it a million times in thread A and a million times in thread B, and this is an add instruction. You know, I can't, it's not an assembly divided into any pieces. But that instruction is not atomic. That the actual implementation of this instruction on many x86 processors, basically does something where it like has a separate load, you know, add and store operation. And it's possible when we have this happening in two threads that the other thread can happen in between those in some way. And that we can have that same lost write scenario we saw when I introduced that bank account example last time. And we can see this empirically. So if I look at the typical values, what I did is I took this program and I ran it a lot of times. And this is a histogram of the actual values I got out. And our expected value is this right here, this 2 million. That's if all the ads actually happened. And we can see what usually ends up happening is it seems like I get around a million, sometimes even less than that. And probably what's happening is that basically, one of the thread's values, gets written last and ignores the other thread's write. It doesn't load the values written incremented by the other thread, so we get a million. And these values that are less than a million are probably that sometimes we read values from the other thread that are before it finished and we end up losing even more additions. So, this is something you'll actually see, and it's because that add to memory instruction is really implemented with multiple steps, and those steps, can be interleaved in various ways with what other cores are doing. Okay. So, mentioned this idea of atomic, and I said, some things are usually atomic, so the question might be, how do we know what is and isn't atomic? And the answer is, the processor designer better tell you. If they don't tell you, you're not going to know. We're going to assume, for thinking about, how do we do anything, that loads and stores of words, so natural size values are atomic. And our hope is that that's, sort of what the processor designer will tell us is atomic. And given that, we're going to think about, how can we do anything useful? Because clearly, I can't just, use the things that aren't atomic, or else I'll get answers that, are completely inconsistent all the time. So how do I, get useful results, knowing that only some things are atomic? And to think about that, we're going to think about a problem of coordinating two different things. We're going to do that with people instead of threads, just, to have something that's a little easier to think about as a thought problem. This is borrowed from our recommended textbook. So let's say we have some roommates, Alice and Bob, who went to keep a fridge stocked with milk, and they run into this problem that Alice, checks for milk, says, okay, there's no milk, goes and buys some, and Bob, while Alice is buying milk, checks for milk and buys some, and they end up with twice as much milk as they really want. So how can these roommates coordinate better? And you might say, okay, so, just leave a note. That's sort of our natural solution. And we can think of leaving a note as kind of analogous to setting a variable and checking for the note as analogous to loading the variable. So this leaving notes and checking for notes sort of maps naturally to loading a value and storing a value at a particular location. And so that gives us sort of an algorithm like this for what Alice and Bob should do. They'll check for milk. If there's no milk, they'll first check whether there's a note, and this conceptually is like load note. And if not, they'll, store note equals one, and then remove the note, which you can think of as storing a zero. And we know that, these operations are going to be atomic. So that seems fun. So this algorithm doesn't work. So what is wrong? And it doesn't work for a reason that makes sense if we think about this as sort of something we'd implement in a machine, but where if this happened in person, you'd say, that's never going to happen. And there's something about a disconnect between our model and sort of the, you know, this real world situation. Give another 15 seconds or so. So most people have figured out the biggest issue, which I think is the only one, which is that we can have this interleaving. That Alice checks for milk, says, okay, there's no milk, make sure there's no note, says, okay, gonna start writing a note. Bob arrives, says, hi, Alice, checks for milk, looks at Alice, says, doesn't see a note yet, says, okay, gonna have to leave my own note. And they both end up buying milk and leaving a note. So what's happening here is, you know, wouldn't work in the real world because we kind of have some, as humans, some extra checking that when we're both deciding to leave a note at the same place. But that's not what this, you know, sort of algorithm actually says to do. So we end up here that we still end up with, you know, milk being bought twice, even though we had this note-taking system. Now, some of you selected the options I gave for, you know, not getting milk, and that's usually not a way we'll err here because, you know, if Alice ever, you know, checks for a note and doesn't find something, you know, if Alice checks at the wrong time, we just get extra milk. So questions about, you know, this problem here. So a natural solution you might come up with is that, okay, well, the problem here is that we left a note too late, right? So because the problem was that Bob could be checking for a note before we actually left it. So let's just leave the note earlier. So sort of our simple answer might be, okay, let's leave the note earlier. And This leads to something that some of you selected for the last thing as a problem, which is that, you know, as something that, you know, humans wouldn't do, but machines could do, you know, they'll look at the note they wrote and read it themselves. That they'll say, oh, there's a note because I left one. Now, this we can avoid. And this is pretty easy to avoid. We just need to say, we need to care about who the note's from. So here we go. So Alice leaves a note from Alice, checks if there's a note from Bob. And we have the sort of opposite for Bob. And if we imagine how does this turn into loads and stores, we could just have these be two separate variables with two separate memory locations. And say, okay, this seems fine. But this still has a problem. Still doesn't work. Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, so a plurality have the right answer, but let's go through it since this is definitely a harder thing. So this is an example of the bad scenario which can happen, is that Alice leaves her note. She checks, there's no milk. Bob comes along, leaves his note. And Alice finds Bob's note. Okay, Bob's taking care of it. So, hi, Bob. Yep, you're taking care of it. Great. And Alice gets distracted for a bit, and Bob checks for milk, finds that there's no milk, checks for a note from Alice, but there's still a note from Alice because Alice didn't get around to removing it yet. She says, oh, Alice is taking care of it. Okay. Then removes the note, removes his note, Alice removes her note, and no one ends up buying milk. And the same situation can also happen if Alice checks her milk a little later, which were the two answers on the poll. So question about sort of how this went wrong. So you can see here that we can still err on the side of, you know, not buying milk. In this case, we've sort of twisted the problem in the other direction with our fix, but we still have a problem, and it seems like this is tricky to fix. questions about what happened here. So here, we're leaving the note too early. Previously, we were leaving it too late. We were leaving it too early and removing it too late, basically. Okay, I'd say, well, okay, so I went through a whole bunch of wrong solutions. You know, when we tried to fix it, it was still wrong, just in a different way. Like, is there actually a solution? And the answer is yes. But it's not elegant. So here's sort of the canonical solution. And something you might not like about this solution is that the algorithm for Alice is different than Bob, that we can't have this sort of nice mirror image sort of thing, that something one of them needs to be different. Another thing you might not like about it is that we have this sort of busy loop here. To make this work. And that basically is that we've decided that Alice is going to wait for a note from Bob is how we're going to resolve this. And we're going to ensure some ordering that way and avoid the problem. And I'm telling you that this works. Actually proving that is a lot of work and something we're going to want to avoid. Also, I have this algorithm where I need to do a different thing for Alice and Bob, and this seems awkward if we're thinking about what if there's a third roommate, you know. So what if we have Charlie here? What would that look like? How do we extend that? There's a way of doing it, but it's not obvious. It's not, doesn't have this symmetry we'd expect. So, we're not going to use this method of synchronizing threads. And the main purpose of talking about this is to point out that we want to use some tools that are going to give us nice guarantees about when things happen. Because otherwise, it's going to be really hard to make things work consistently. That things that seem like they work, you're going to miss these corner cases of exactly where something can sneak in and mess up your intuition about what should happen. But if you wanted to look up sort of what the general algorithm was, this is something called Peterson's algorithm is the general solution. But we're not going to use that. We're not even going to use things built on that. Instead, we're going to use special hardware support, that we're going to rely on the hardware to avoid us having to do ugly things like this. To have special instructions for us that are going to help us coordinate two different threads. And we'll talk about what those are sometime later. Okay. And we're going to rely on special hardware support, and I'll go into the hardware support later, but first we'll go into the abstraction that we're going to build on top of that hardware support. And this is an abstraction very much like the one we actually wanted here. We wanted only Alice or Bob to be actually, you know, buying milk at a time and checking for milk. We wanted this whole operation here. We wanted this operation to be, you know, wanted this to happen one at a time, you know, with no one else doing it. No one else doing it. And we're going to talk about an abstraction to give us that property, which we'll call mutual exclusion. That only one thread does a thing at a time, that if multiple threads want to do the thing, they take turns. And our example is like that checking for and buying milk together. That's the thing we wanted mutual exclusion for. We wanted the threads to take turns. And as a vocabulary term, we're going to call the code that encompasses that mutually exclusive thing a critical section. And we're going to have an abstraction that we can use to provide mutual exclusion and implement critical sections. Sorry, this is result of of mutual exclusion. We're going to call have an abstraction to implement these critical sections called a lock. And this is an abstraction where a thread can hold a lock, and when one thread is holding a lock, no other thread can have it. And so this is our interface for creating critical sections. So a lock, we're going to think of it as an object with two operations, one which we're going to call either acquire or lock, and the other which we're going to call either release or unlock. And the acquire or lock operation is going to wait until the lock is free. So kind of like, you know, what the solution we ended up with does, we're going to wait for something, but we're just going to wait for the lock to be free, meaning that either no other thread has acquired it, or if another thread acquired it, it released it. So we're going to wait for that, then grab it. So this lock operation, you know, might wait. And then we're going to have this release or unlock operation, which if someone else is waiting for the lock, we'll let them continue. And the pattern we're going to use is when we have some sort of shared resource, like our milk in the fridge, we're going to acquire the lock before we use it and release it afterwards, so we don't have to worry about what if someone else is trying to do something with this while at the same time. So questions about this lock abstraction? So, I told you about the abstraction, and this is something that pthreads provides. So, there's a type called mutex. So, mutex basically stands for mutual exclusion. That's a lock. It has a lock operation and an unlock operation, and that would be equivalent to this code. So there's a question like, okay, I told you that this lock operation waits till the lock is free and then grabs it. So the question is, what happens if two threads are running this code? That if two threads try to acquire the lock. So acquiring the lock, these are going to be atomic operations. So there's not going to be any notion that you can, I guess I should maybe be more clear, you know, so the grabbing, this grabbing is going to be atomic. So only one thread is going to be able to grab the lock because either the lock is not free, you know, or not. So, you know, so if multiple threads want the lock, they'll only get it one at a time. So if we have two threads trying to acquire the lock, they'll end up taking turns. So another question is, can there be a race condition when multiple things need a lock? And the answer is going to be, if we're losing the same lock, no, because they'll take turns in getting the lock. And something conceptual here, I guess I should say, so free means that, you know, it's available for you to grab. So some other questions about these locks is, so is there a time limit? And the answer is, with this abstraction, no. We would have to add it if we wanted one. Another question is, what determines the order in which they take turns? We haven't specified. So if we're thinking of concretely of pthread mutexes, which you can use on your system, POSIX has just said, hey, the system can do whatever it wants, pretty much. As far as what order things happen in, except that it should do what the scheduler is trying to do. So there's a scheduling policy with priority. You'd hope that the highest priority thread would get the lock first, but I wouldn't even expect that to happen. Another question is, if there's not a limit on how long a thread can hold a lock, what happens if a thread has a lock and, sleeps for a long time before releasing it? Well, the other threads are not going to be able to run for a while. Another question is, can a thread acquire a lock from multiple objects? So in this example, I'm kind of showing the lock as protecting one thing. But notice that there's not actually anything about this code that uses the lock. So we can, as programmers using locks, decide what our rules are going to be for when we lock and when we unlock. And we could decide, for example, that before you use any of a set of objects, you acquire a lock if we wanted to. And we just have to choose those rules in a way which makes sure that we don't have to worry about inconsistent behavior. Other questions before I move on to third lock API. Okay, so this is the POSIX API for locks. So we have this init, or you can set it up initially, and this lock and unlock operation. We also have an XV6 API for locks, which are here called spin locks. So there's an init lock function, an acquire function, and a release function. And so otherwise the interface is pretty much the same. Okay, so questions. Okay, so given that we've seen locks, let's try to reason about here an example that uses locks. So here I have two threads. We use locks and we have two global variables, and they write, and let's say that one thread runs the code in thread A, one thread runs the code in thread B, and the question is, what are the values of 1 and 2 after they run, which are possible? rather... seconds, I guess. Okay, so let's go with the easy ones. So one thing that could happen is that this waiting operation here could never come up, that we never have to worry about the lock being full because all of A happens before B runs or vice versa. So in that case, we have the order A1, then A2, then B1, B2, or vice versa. And this would give us the thread A and A, or sorry, thread B and B and thread A and A, other order answers, which most people got. So then we have to worry about, you know, what can happen in between. And so one thing we can think about is that, well, let's say A1 happens first. What can happen after that? And one possibility, so we can have A1 happen, and then we could either have A2 happen again, which we've seen before, or we could have B1 happen. Why is that possible? Well, once this lock is released here, thread B can acquire the lock to run B1. And then after B1 happens, we can say, okay, so then what can happen after that? And we have two possibilities. So one possibility is that, well, while we're setting one here, we could have thread A run A2. And if that happens, we would have this lock here would be waiting for this, for the unlock. And after that unlock, B2 would run, which gives us this order here where we get so B and another B and B. Another possibility is that B1 runs and then B2 gets to get the lock immediately. That even though thread A wanted to get it, it's going to have to wait instead. That rather than this lock waiting, thread B's lock of 2 waiting for A's unlock, it's the other way around. And thread A's lock of 2 waits for B's unlock. So in that case, B2 will finish and then A2 will finish, and we end up with A1, B1, B2, A2. And basically, it ends up that all of thread B kind of runs in the mid between thread A's two writes. And we end up seeing the value from B and the value from A. So there's one more possibility which might make sense, and that's the question is whether we could have this, we could see 2 in thread B and 1 in thread A at the same time. Now, for that to happen, what would need to happen is that this 2 would need to have run sometime after the 1 in thread A. And we have a problem here, which that means that the 1 in thread A and it ran there. Is that it? So is that possible? Is our question. So in that case, the order, yeah, someone says the order would need to be that we have B1, then A1, than A to B to, because if we want to get, the question is this possible? So to have this happen, B1 needs to happen, and then A1, but that this can't happen. So the reason why this can't happen is because we have this lock one, it's not possible for A1 to run until after B2. Because A1 is going to wait for that lock to be released here. So in this scenario, A1 would be waiting for this unlock here. So this order here is not possible. And to really go through this, we just enumerate all the possible orders and look for things like that. We say, okay, B1, then A1, is that possible? Here I say no, because for A1 to run after B1, we need to wait for the unlock. And I could look, do this for all the other orders that might result in the other possibility of having A, B as my results. So these were my answers. Some questions about how I reasoned about this? I know I kind of fumbled this a little bit. Hopefully it's clear. So we want B1, then A1 in order to have A1 win. But if A1 wins, then we can't have, the problem is that we can't have B2 happen at the right time, which is at, would be after A2. Okay, so hopefully go through that. So talked about locks abstractly. And one question you might say is, so we have this lock thing, is that gonna be all we need? Is that, can we just have these locks and then that's enough to coordinate between threads? And the answer is no. And I'm gonna give, you know, one example of this that we've kind of seen before, that is going to be pipes. So if we think of how pipes worked, we mentioned that the read on a pipe will wait for someone to write data for you. And we want to implement this efficiently. We don't want to do something like lock, some lock, you know, if data, then do something else, you know, do something, you know, unlock. We don't want to like have a loop where we do this, even though this would be a valid solution, that we could have a infinite loop where we lock, check if there's data, unlock, then try again, lock, check if there's data, unlock. We could do that, but there's something we don't want to do. That's called busy waiting. And another solution you might come up with for this, if you think cleverly about how locks work, is it seems like when I introduced locks, I didn't actually say that if you that the person who unlocked the lock needed to be the person who locked it, but this is going to be a restriction in practice. And in particular, pthread mutex lock requires that the thread that does the locking is the same as the one that does the unlocking. So if we want to implement in a reasonable way this idea of waiting for someone else, it seems like we don't have a good way of doing that. And this problem comes up a bunch. And for this reason, we're going to have a whole bunch of extra synchronization primitives, so sort of abstractions beyond locks we're going to talk about. I'm going to introduce one today called barriers, and I'm talking about it now before we talk about the details of how locks work, because we're going to use it in an assignment, and I want to make sure you can start it as early as you like. Also, because sort of a good preview of other things we might want, you know, reasons why locks might not be the best interface for what we want to do. And this abstraction is going to be something called a barrier. And to think about it, I'm going to give a use case where the barrier is going to take care of this operation. So our use case is, let's say I have a 100 million element array, and I want to compute it, its minimum, with two processors. So here's my algorithm. I'm going to take 50 million of the elements on each processor, compute the minimum of those 50 million. I'm going to wait for that to finish. Then I'm going to read the two minimums from the two processors and put them together. And this wait operation is what we're going to have an abstraction to help us with. And well, we've seen something which does this, which is pthread join. But the problem with pthread join is, you know, but we don't want to wait for everything, want thread to terminate. For example, maybe we want to do this multiple times. Maybe we want to do other calculations in these two threads after we get the minimum. This is a very common type of scenario which comes up in things like simulations, that in your, say, a weather simulation, you want to like compute a step of the weather for different parts of things, share the results, do the next step. And if we were using the pthread join strategy, we need to like start new threads all over again each time. Here we just want to do that same sort of wait for things to finish and move on. So the barrier is going to be an abstraction to help us with this kind of computation, and it's going to have this API. We're going to have an initialize operation where we specify the number of threads we want to have wait. And we're going to have this wait operation, which is going to both say that I'm done and also wait for everyone else to finish. So the idea is that every thread uses this barrier and uses this wait operation. And only when all the threads have waited does the wait operation return. So as an example of how this might look with our parallel mins idea, here I have two threads. Each thread computes their partial minimum. Then they call wait. And only after both threads have called wait do we compute sort of the minimum of the minimums. So if we wanted to do this with a lock, well, we wouldn't have a convenient way of doing this wait operation. We'd have to do something like, you know, lock something, and if the count, you know, is not equal to 2, unlock and try again. You know, we'd have to do some busy waiting thing like this, and we don't want to do that. We want to wait. We want to just wait and have that be implemented in some efficient way. When we talk about other synchronization primitives, we'll talk about how we could implement this efficiently. But for now, we'll just hope that this wait operation is implemented in a way which doesn't involve like just checking something over and over again. And this is something that we couldn't really do with a lock, at least not in a convenient way. So questions about this barrier use case? Now, so the question is, why in my alternative using a lock did I need a while loop? So I'll expand this code. So sort of a naive way of trying to implement this with a lock would be that we'd have our wait would be, you know, we lock some lock, and we increment a done count. We acquire a lock before doing this, so we can make sure we read it. And, you know, if done count, you know, so this is a naive / slow version, is equal to 2, we unlock and return. Otherwise, you know, we have a loop where we check if the done count is not 2, and while it is, we unlock and then relock. So why would we unlock and relock? So someone else can change the done count. But we need to have this lock so we don't, you know, have issues with what done count having, you know, partial rights and having, like, having us try to add something, but the add gets lost, like we saw with the bank account example. So does that answer questions about sort of what my hypothetical bad way of implementing this with a lock would be? Okay. So we can see that this works. This is a functional implementation, but it's just super inefficient. This is sort of wasting time, wasting resources. So we're going to have implementations of this that are much more efficient, and we'll talk about how we do that over the next couple weeks, like what sort of thing you would do to make this actually efficient. And that's going to have to be that we're not going to implement this in terms of just locks. Now, with the barriers I've shown so far, it looks like this is kind of a single-use thing. And barriers are generally going to be actually multiple uses. And this is sort of where they're really convenient for something. So the classic example is something like a simulation I mentioned, like a weather simulation. So let's say I have a weather simulation where I divide up sort of my land into different squares and assign each, say, square to a thread. And each thread runs a function which computes the new weather for that square from the weather of that square and all its neighbors. So what I've done here is I've said, okay, I have the results at from each time for each square. And before I can compute my next results, I need to wait for everyone else to get me their results. And this barrier wait lets me do that. So thread here, so here, when I call this first wait, I'm both having thread 1 wait for thread 0 to compute its results that it's going to need later, and thread 0 waiting for thread 1 to compute its results that wait later. That it needs later. And I have a second wait, which is going to handle the next step. And in the next step, we kind of repeat this process where thread one's results are going to be, thread zero's results are going to be needed by thread one, and thread one's results are going to be needed by thread zero. So a question is, does this mean we need barriers for the life assignment? So the life assignment, the easiest way of doing it is with barriers. It's not the only way to do it, but it is the easiest. Because this abstraction is very suitable to this sort of simulation-like things where you divide up things between two threads and have them coordinate after particular time steps. And this pattern comes up all the time in scientific computing, and it also is useful in a bunch of other places, is particularly when you're trying to use multiple threads in order to get more computation done, where it's that parallelism case, not the concurrency case. So questions about this barrier reuse example? Here, we see barriers being used to make sure that, you know, for example, this write of results 1-1 happens before thread 0 reads it. Okay. So POSIX provides barriers. So there's a pthread barrier T, there's this init operation, and a wait operation. Okay, so that's my brief discussion of barriers, and this is kind of a preview of some things we'll look at later. That we're going to talk a bunch about how locks work, but when we're actually writing multi-threaded code, we're often going to find that locks just aren't good enough. And barriers are kind of an example of a particular use case where the abstraction we want isn't locks. Locks are not a convenient way to handle that sort of have everyone wait for everyone else operation, even though we can do it with locks just very inefficiently. So we're going to have these more general ideas, and what I've listed as condition variables and monitors and counting semaphores, these are going to be very general. So they're going to be kind of, you know, do strictly more than locks can. And we'll also have talk about reader-writer locks, which are kind of, you know, a, you know, locks with extra features. That's sort of as a preview. Now, with locks and barriers, we can write a lot of programs that like do things in multiple threads, but one thing that we want to think about is how do things work with locks? When do we need locks? And one thing where this comes up a bunch is with things like, you know, vector and so on. So one question is like, can you use a vector for multiple threads? And you might say, okay, well, you know, if one thread is doing vector 0 and the other thread is doing vector.pushback, it seems like those should or shouldn't interfere. And to know the answer to the question of like, can I have two threads doing this, you have to think about how is it implemented. And in the case of these two operations, well, there's a problem if the array inside the vector gets reallocated. But we would like to, you know, be able to reason about this, because if we think about this example here, kind of one of the things I want to do is, you know, have two threads reading from what is probably the same vector. And the question is that going to work? And I mentioned that, well, you know, you can't push back and read from a vector from two different threads at the same time and expect that to work. So I'd say, what's guaranteed? And generally, the C++ containers guarantee enough that this sort of thing is going to work. And the way they do that is they basically say, you can have multiple threads read anything at the same time, and you can have them modify thing. Read anything that another thread is not modifying. And if you want to resize the container, you can add or remove elements only if no other threads are using the container. So this is fine because the containers aren't being resized. Because, you know, fine, because results, you know, is fixed size. But if we were doing something like resizing the results vector, if it was a vector, that would not be okay. Because every read of result could potentially, you know, be accessing a pointer that's changing. And as for how would you know this? Well, the reason we know it for the C++ things like vector is that the authors of the C++ library had to tell us. You know, we can't like reliably know whether we can use a library without, you know, making sure we take turns, without having the library author tell us how things work well enough. And related to that issue, there's something surprising about vectors of bools. So I told you for that this code here would work if results was a vector, but there's an exception, which is that if we have vectors of bools, they don't work in this way. So vectors of bools, you can't read and write at the same time from two different threads, even if you're reading and writing different elements. And the reason why is that the C++ people wanted to put multiple bools in one int, and that's not atomic, which means that they're, you know, that if you do V of 0 and V of 1, these might, you know, these might read and write the same byte. So that's just an exception. And an example of why, when you're using a library, you want to know what the library authors actually guarantee. So questions about this idea of, like, when can we safely use a shared, you know, thing like a vector? So the question is, aren't two threads accessing the container in that special case? So what I'm saying is that we can't do something like, so like have be writing to V1 and reading from V0 in a vector of bools, but in a vector of ints, that would be fine because we can, we're not reading any element another thread is modifying, and that's the and we're not adding or removing elements. So the question is, would this rule apply if we made our own struct and put it in a vector? If you have a struct, a vector of structs, then this exception doesn't apply. This exception only applies to vector of bools. Otherwise, it follows these rules. You can read any element no other thread is modifying, and multiple threads can read anything at the same time that no one's modifying. So our next topic is going to be about implementing locks. And first, we're going to talk about the simple way of implementing locks on a single core. And the simplest thing is we could just disable interrupts. Because on a single core, all we're worried about is context switches. How do context switches happen? Some sort of exception triggers them. And the exceptions we're worried about are exceptions from external events. So we can just disable those. The processor supports that. And basically, like, if I press a key and interrupts are disabled, that key press won't cause the OS to run until after exceptions are re-enabled. And x86 has some instructions to do this. And this is a real way we can implement locks. Our lock operation can ignore the lock object and disable interrupts. Our unlock can re-enable them. And on a single core, this implements locks, but it has some other problems. For example, you know, these locks hang the system. This doesn't mean that they're useless, because if, you know, this is being just used by the OS, this is actually fine. And this is going to be part of how we implement locks as we move on, which we'll talk about next time. So this is where I'll leave off for today. Questions. So the question is, why would interrupts need to be disabled? So if we disable interrupts, then, you know, this is then no other thread can run while we're doing whatever we're doing. And that solves the problem of having a lock in the other, having other thread, you know, not do something in the middle of the lock being held. The question is, don't we just want to lock a specific resource? That would seem advantageous. And in this design, we're saying, well, we only have a single core anyway, so we're just going to treat all locks as global locks. But, you know, that idea is certainly something you wouldn't want to do if we had some way of, you know, having multiple things happen at the same time, despite us having this lock being held. The question is, so this is naive implementation? Yes.